deaths on Gaza hospitals in just 10 days. Nothing can justify the Zionist brutishness. They even hit the ambulances which carry the injured with rockets. Many of the hospital personnel have been martyred in such attacks. My friends, my colleagues, my family. As you look at the city from the roof of the hospital, you see a catastrophe. Respiratory infections are raging through Gaza. The premature babies are dying in hospitals because the electricity is cut off. And children are dying one by one because of starvation and dehydration. Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel. Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel. Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel.
This program is dedicated to the martyrs of Gaza.
Tonight on Exposé, Western media inaccurately describe the reason behind Aaron Bushnell's actions as a protest on the Israeli-Hamas war, despite him stating it was to protest the genocide of Palestinians at the hands of the Zionist entity. Now, the New York Times is embroiled in controversy over a discredited article claiming Hamas sexually assaulted a Zionist settler during the Al-Aqsa flood operation. And Bushnell, hailed as a hero, receiving praise from many pro-Palestinian activists who saw his extreme act of protest as a success in drawing attention to the genocide and suffering of the Palestinian people. Welcome to Exposé, the show that leaves no stone unturned. Sunday, February 24, Aaron Bushnell, an active duty member of the U.S. Air Force, passed away from injuries sustained in the fire he lit himself with in front of the Israeli entity embassy the day before in Washington, D.C., in protest of the Israeli genocide on Palestinians and the complicity of his government in the Zionist genocide. Bushnell's final words were, "Free Palestine." In a video recorded on his way to the embassy, Bushnell said, "I will no longer be complicit in genocide. I'm about to engage in an extreme act of protest, but compared to what people have been experiencing in Palestine at the hands of their colonizers, it's not extreme at all. This is what our ruling class has decided will be normal." Bushnell explained in the video he streamed before he set himself on fire. Fuad Itayim, our broadcast expert and writer at The Cradle in Fake News Exposé. Aaron Bushnell, a name that will go down in history as a man who opted to sacrifice his own life to protest his country's involvement in genocide against the Palestinian people. However, as expected, Western and Zionist media made sure to smear his name every chance they got, and went as far as accuse him of being mentally ill. Fuad will tell us more about this smearing campaign. Go ahead, Fuad. Marwa.
So let's start with MSNBC's coverage of Aaron Bushnell and his heroic self-immolation. So Aaron Bushnell, the U.S. Air Force airman. MSNBC referred to his heroic sacrifice as a protest against the Israel-Hamas war, simplifying it completely, even though he clearly stated in his video that this was an extreme form of protest in solidarity with the Palestinians who are having a genocide waged against them. This was the only coverage that MSNBC did on Aaron Bushnell, and it wasn't shared either on their website or on their social media. But the internet caught it. So here's the clip that we found on YouTube of that live report aired on MSNBC, where they go the extra mile in fake news, inaccuracy, and even disrespect, airing the suicide hotline to imply that Aaron Bushnell was crazy and that this was done because of a mental health issue instead of an extreme form of protest against a genocide, ongoing genocide.
This is so disrespectful.
Yesterday, 25-year-old Aaron Bushnell of San Antonio, Texas, the active-duty airman in the U.S. Air Force who set himself on fire outside the Israeli embassy in an apparent protest against the Israel-Hamas war, has died. That identification made by Metropolitan Police here. Bushnell filmed his own self-immolation on his cell phone, yelling, "Free Palestine," before collapsing to the ground outside the embassy. He was rushed to the hospital for treatment, but later succumbed to his injuries. And if you or someone you know is in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the suicide aid.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is one example of Western mainstream media basically assuming the role of defense attorneys for Israel through its narratives, which have unfortunately successfully portrayed an occupying power as a victim. Mm-hmm. So our audience is going to see more about that in the mainstream media section with Julia. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong, I don't mean to imply that every single media outlet portrayed this terribly. For example, CNN, while their headline was lacking some really crucial context, surprisingly their televised coverage of the matter was not so bad. Mm-hmm. So let's focus on that aspect and take a look.
Authorities identified Aaron Bushnell as the person who, on Sunday, set himself on fire. The 25-year-old was an active-duty member of the U.S. Air Force. CNN's Gabe Cohen joins us now with the details. And Gabe, this is something that he did in protest.
Yeah, that's correct. And we're learning much more about this 25-year-old active-duty airman, Aaron Bushnell, as you mentioned. He's from San Antonio, Texas, and he live-streamed his actions on Sunday in broad daylight on the streets of D.C. outside the Israeli embassy. We are not going to show that video. It is extremely graphic and disturbing. I have watched the video. I can tell you at the beginning, at the start of it, you can see Bushnell walking up to the embassy on the street in his military fatigues. He's speaking calmly to the camera. I want to read a portion of what he says. He said, quote, "I will no longer be complicit in genocide. I'm about to engage in an extreme act of protest. But compared to what people have been experiencing in Palestine at the hands of their colonizers, it is not extreme at all. This is what our ruling class has decided will be normal." He then goes on to pour some sort of accelerant, it looks like, on his head out of a water bottle he was carrying. And then he lights himself on fire, Boris. And as the flames engulf him, you can hear him yelling, free Palestine, again and again, until finally he collapses. And that is when officers, you can see them race in, one of them with a fire extinguisher in their hands, trying to put out the flames. But it takes time. And as we have learned, Bushnell died in the hospital at some point later on. And look, it really speaks to the tensions that are continuing to escalate around the war in Gaza, not just across the world, but here in the United States. We saw a similar incident in December when someone self-immolated, lit themselves on fire outside of the Israeli consulate in Atlanta. But this feels different. This is an active duty member of the military burning himself to death on the streets of the nation's capital.
Wow, Fuad. I mean, that is refreshing despite the fact that it's a very painful incident. But, I mean, CNN.
This was a bit better. So they relayed his message. They recounted his last words. They said much more clearly that this was an extreme form of protest instead of calling him crazy like MSNBC did, basically. But, of course, it's CNN. So they didn't mention that Israel is starving and killing babies. They didn't go into detail about the horrific genocide that's ongoing that we're witnessing on a daily basis. But this may be the best that we can expect from Western mainstream media.
And it is a very, very advanced position, if I may. Thank you very much, Fuad,
for your analysis
in fake news expose. Ladies and gents, now we move on to digital mainstream media. Mainstream media is not doing a sufficient enough job of informing the audience about the severity of the atrocities being committed by the Zionist entity in Gaza. Julia Qasim, our mainstream media expert, joins us to tell us more about it. The floor is yours, Julia.
Thanks, Marwa. So to the extent that mainstream media does actually cover the genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza, major outlets like the New York Times or the Washington Post have published content that's obviously skewed towards the Zionist entity, too little, too late, and, 5 months after the fact if they decide to admit to the crimes at all. So take, for example, the controversy that is currently engulfing the New York Times, Marwa, which is now exposed, one of the co-authors of a discredited piece that accused the Palestinian resistance Hamas of rape on October 7th, Al-Aqsa flood operation, as being a former member of the IOF's intelligence unit and had not even worked as a journalist at all prior to taking a central role in the New York Times coverage of wow. October 7th. Mm-hmm. So we've covered a story in earlier expose segments, but this time it's been revealed that Annette Schwartz, the co-author of the badly flawed article How Hamas Weaponized Sexual Violence, liked posts on social media that glorified the genocide against Palestinians and had no past bylines in journalism.
So audacious that something that only mainstream media would attempt, something so unprofessional and crazy, doesn't it?
Right. As we remember, the article made false claims of sexual violence by Hamas on October 7th. This was a regular tactic employed by the Palestinian Resistance Group as a weapon of war. So the family of a soldier who was allegedly attacked by Hamas on that particular day, according to this piece, and was portrayed as a key character in the story about rape, Gal Abdush, was furious and actually condemned the account of their daughter. So the family claimed to have no clue whatsoever that Gal had been sexually assaulted, no proof to back up their allegations, and no knowledge that the Times was going to publish a story alleging that their daughter had been raped. So a third of the article was devoted to the story of Gal Abdush, written by this former IDF intelligence soldier. And this scandal just brings us back to the unconfirmed story about the 40 beheaded babies, which no mainstream media sources ever really investigated.
Definitely. As if these 40 babies have no parents to tell us their stories. Just like, for example, the parents of Abdush said that none of this that was mentioned in the New York Times was actually true. It was all fiction. It was not a fact whatsoever. So how about other pieces like that, like the 40 babies, or like mass rape, or like, for example, the attack on the desert concert, for that matter.
Now, following up on what Fuad was talking about in the fake news segment of the broadcast media, concerning the misrepresentation of Aaron Bushnell's self-immolation in support of the Palestinian people, we have a piece by the Washington Post entitled, "Aaron Bushnell Was Not a Hero. Self-immolation is not an act of political protest we should celebrate." Mm-hmm. In this piece, Ramesh Ponnuru, a contributing columnist to the Washington Post, was adamant on showing his discontentment that Bushnell's act of protest has earned him some post-mortem praise, with activists calling him a hero and calling his self-immolation a wake-up call. So he was especially frustrated that the Jewish Voice for Peace honored Bushnell by calling his self-immolation a final act of solidarity. Mm-hmm. This piece also condemned Cornel West, a progressive academic who's running for president in the U.S., for saying we should never forget Bushnell's courage. Mm-hmm. And it also condemned Green Party candidate Jill Stein for quoting Bushnell and writing, "This extraordinary sacrifice brings into greater focus the immense horror that our government is committing in our name." Ponnuru also concludes in an opinion piece that these economists are irresponsible, they are also false.
Wow.
So this, Marwa, shows how immediately after Bushnell's death, coverage purposefully excluded the reason why he was protesting and the fact that it was done to shed light on the complicity of the U.S. government in the genocide waged on Gaza by the Zionist entity, and rather the coverage shifted to why people should not continue, consider his act as protest, but as suicide.
Mm-hmm. Which is definitely, it tells you a lot about the people who support Zionist Israel and how their mentality, when the narrative doesn't serve them, their mentality goes directly into either calling people terrorists or calling them mentally ill. Anyways, I want to thank you very much, Ms. Julia Qasim, for telling us the latest about the digital mainstream media, especially about the hero Aaron Bushnell. Now, ladies and gents, we move on to social media expose. Whether or not you agree with Aaron Bushnell's form of extreme protest or not, he managed with his last breath to speak up on behalf of Palestinians facing extermination at the hands of a genocidal Zionist regime that is being fully funded, supported, and armed by the U.S. government. Aaron did this to make sure that his message was heard, and heard it was on social media, repeated by many supporters of Palestine and denounced by many advocates of Zionist Israel's genocidal behavior against Palestinians. Here is Sima Itayim, our social media expert and editor at The Cradle, with more. There you go.
Thank you for having me, Marwa. So Aaron Bushnell's extreme act of protest, the motive behind that was not only to draw attention to U.S. complicity to the genocidal war in Gaza, but to actually grab the attention mm-hmm. of U.S. media. Mm-hmm. And it's impossible to discuss his actions while ignoring his words. But that is precisely what the media attempted to do. Mm-hmm. We have a tweet by The Barracks Live mm-hmm. on X saying, Aaron Bushnell, an active duty officer in the armed forces, setting himself on fire to protest his deployment to Israel is a very bad look for the U.S. info war. The mainstream media is working overtime for the Pentagon to smear his name. Never stop saying his name. Hashtag Aaron Bushnell.
Wow. So they got it. They got it good, and they got it early that a smearing campaign is being basically pushed by the regime in the U.S. and in Zionist Israel as well.
And this further exposed U.S. media mm-hmm. in its bias and in its silence. So we have another post on X by Danny Haifong at Spirit of Ho, who addressed this matter, saying, mainstream media want us to contemplate the mental health of Aaron Bushnell while ignoring the fact that governments of Israel and the U.S. are committing a genocide in a concentration camp in the year 2024. That's the real sickness here.
I second what Danny is saying, and it is horrific the way that they are trying to portray him as mentally ill.
Yeah, or just unstable, because they can't even make the case that he's mentally ill. You know, grew up in a religious household, has anarchist background,
and whatnot, just trying to tell the world that he's not sane.
Exactly. So we have also, as Fuad mentioned earlier, CNN handled the news of this extreme act of protest surprisingly in a more truthful and professional way than we actually expected mm-hmm. this time. So there's a post on X by Caitlin Johnstone, who quote tweeted a video of CNN's coverage of Bushnell's act of protest, saying, he did it. Aaron Bushnell forced this to happen. He did something so jarring and impactful that the mass media would be forced to report the raw facts about it if they want to avoid internal conflict like CNN and NYT have been experiencing in recent weeks. He left them no choice. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the social media campaign to honor Aaron Bushnell's sacrifice on behalf of Palestine is still sweeping social media platforms all over the world. Mm-hmm. Like this Facebook post by Sean King, who's a New York Times best-selling author of Make Change. He's also co-founder of Grassroots Law, mm-hmm. And he happens to have a follower base of 2.5 million. Mm-hmm. So he posted a photo of Bushnell and wrote, Aaron Bushnell, the U.S. Air Force veteran who gave his life to help stop the genocide of Palestinians, has passed away. I want to honor a young man that was so disturbed by the genocide of Palestinians that he set himself on fire yesterday at the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. Instead of harming someone else, he made a choice that, of course, seems strange and disturbing to all of us, but I empathize with him. Daily, I grapple with just how ineffective we all are at stopping this. And sometimes I feel like my heart and soul and brain have been broken by all of this evil. It's hard to know what to do in this moment. Please pray for his family and be encouraged by the sacrifice he made.
Well, definitely that shows a lot how much support the extreme act of protest by Aaron Bushnell was received by many, not only in the East, where we, the natives, have a struggle against colonizers represented by the Zionist Israelis, but also in the West, whether in Australia, the U.S., or, for example, Europe, for that matter. And people are seeing beyond what the mainstream media usually tries to portray as being nonsensical, not facts, fake news, or even mentally ill people. But I want to thank you very much for telling us the reacts of people on social media, whether on X or on Facebook. Sima, it's always a pleasure having you on board with us. Now, ladies and gents, we move on to Figures Exposé. Now, half the people who responded to a national poll conducted by the University of Massachusetts Amherst in February believe that the Zionist Israeli entity is committing genocide against the Palestinian people living in Gaza, according to the recently released poll results. Now, the poll, which used a sample of 1,064 U.S. adults, was split exactly in half on the question, is the Israeli entity committing genocide against the Palestinian people living in Gaza? 50% said Zionist Israel was probably or definitely committing genocide, and 50% said Zionist Israel was probably or definitely not committing genocide. Here is the full breakdown according to the poll. 18% believe Zionist Israel is definitely committing genocide. 32% believe Zionist Israel is probably committing genocide. And 24% believe Zionist Israel is probably not committing genocide. And 26% believe Zionist Israel is definitely not committing genocide. Now, respondents also answered a question on their support for Zionist Israel's military operation in Gaza since October 7 and about the $10 billion U.S. dollars in military aid to Zionist Israel in support of their war on Palestinians. Now, a plurality of respondents supported the Israeli entity's military operation with 43% in support, 26% opposing, and 32% said neither. But respondents were more evenly divided on the question of U.S. aid, where 36% supported the aid to Zionist Israel and 35% opposed the aid, with 29% undecided. Now, let us move on to the most notable exposé voices for this week. Now, as the world grapples with Bushnell's self-immolation, many took to social media to post their thoughts. Many who support Palestinians described him as a hero and paid tribute to him, celebrating his act of extreme form of protest for its impact, primarily raising awareness for the Palestinians' plight and genocide. Our first voice for tonight comes from Instagram with Hassanain Jaffer, who said he hoped to find more words to do Aaron justice. Here is Hassanain's voice.
One of the last things Aaron Bushnell said before he started the bio was that he didn't consider his action to be extreme because this is what our ruling classes have decided will be normal. This is really profound framing. He really understood the idea that racial capitalism relied on us accepting their narrative as the normal. Somehow it's normal to witness an entire population of people being displaced and starving, whilst our response should be sitting in our fancy government chambers and deciding that X politician is worth voting for because they called for a temporary ceasefire or a humanitarian pause in the fighting. There is no normal anymore. The ruling class desperately want us to return to their version of normal so that we can continue participating and fueling their system and remain too exhausted to continue questioning their narrative. An abnormal world requires abnormal responses. An extreme world requires extreme responses. You can disagree with self-immolation as a form of protest, but you have to be consistent. The media was all over this when it was happening during the Arab Spring. You cannot disagree with the effectiveness, the selflessness of this sort of response, because what we are responding to is white phosphorus burning the skin off of children playing with kites. As Aaron reminded us with his final words, free Palestine.
Now, many social media users were furious at the Western and Zionist media for labeling Aaron Bushnell as a mentally ill individual instead of focusing on the reason he chose this form of extreme protest through self-immolation. Blakely Bartley on TikTok refused to accept the smearing campaign and replied by saying that maybe it's you who is mentally ill. Here is Blakely's voice from TikTok.
To all the people that are smearing Aaron Bushnell and saying that he was mentally ill, maybe it's you. Maybe it's the fact that you've become so disconnected from your own humanity that you can continue to watch a live stream genocide for 4 months and feel nothing. People are already digging into his background trying to find any way they can to smear him. There is no evidence that he was mentally ill. But even if he was, calling him mentally ill because he decided to engage in an extreme form of protest as our government ignores us while they enable a genocide tells me that you know nothing about mental illness. He knew exactly what he was doing. He wrote a will in which he said he wanted the remainder of his money to go to the Palestinian Children's Fund. He said that he wanted his neighbor to keep his cat. If any of you saw the video, he was extremely calm and very clear about what he was doing as he was doing it. You're trying to smear him in death because it's easier than having to ask yourself what would drive a 25-year-old to do such an extreme action.
Now, since Aaron Bushnell was an active duty member of the U.S. Air Force, some U.S. servicemen like TikToker at Big Bearded Chief were sad to see one of their own self-immolate to support a cause. But TikTokers like Reid Adel replied to them in a very rational way. Let us hear Reid's voice.
It's just sad that anyone feels they have to do that.
You're absolutely right. It's sad that active duty U.S. Air Force member had to self-emulate in order to garner attention and sympathy for the Palestinian cause, because the U.S. government continues to ignore our calls for a ceasefire now. Aaron Bushnell did not commit suicide. Aaron Bushnell committed an act of extreme protest. He did not have a mental illness. He was clear in his intention. And it is completely inappropriate for you in the media to spin story of mental illness when Aaron Bushnell does not have a history of that, nor you are deflecting. Rest in power.
Now, ladies and gents, with that, we conclude our expose for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Expose. The truth is just a revelation away.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Palestinians abducted by Israeli regime forces since the start of the war are returning to Gaza with harrowing accounts of mock executions, constant beatings, and humiliating mistreatment. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, Naeem Youssef Salem Abu al-Hassan, a 19-year-old from Jabalia, northern Gaza, told Middle East Eye he had been abducted with other young men aged 18 to 25 after remaining residents were ordered by Israeli regime forces to leave the city on December 27, 2023. By then, he said, he and his extended family had endured weeks of airstrikes, tank attacks, and a sniper fire, which had destroyed much of the neighborhood and killed a number of his relatives. Soon afterward, Hassan said Israeli regime troops had asked him to identify two bodies in the street who they said were fighters. Hassan said he did not know the identities of the bodies and had no connections with the fighters. He said, "They didn't believe me and insisted that I recognize them, otherwise they would shoot me and drop me next to the bodies. I didn't know what to say. Then they placed me facing the wall on my knees." Hassan said the troops then kicked him and called him a liar. He was handcuffed, blindfolded, and dragged to a nearby house where other abductees were also being held. He said, "One soldier was smoking a cigarette and trying to burn me on my face. I told him I can't take it, so he started hitting and kicking me." That night, the men were rounded up and taken out to the street where, Hassan said, they were surrounded by troops and tanks. Deep holes had been dug in the street, and a troop started to push him towards one of the holes. He said, "I felt, that's it. He will definitely kill me now. This will probably be my last breath." Instead, the men were loaded on two trucks. They were driven around for several hours, all the while being cursed, kicked, and beaten by the troops guarding them. Then they were moved to a different vehicle and driven around some more, still being beaten. Eventually, they were dropped at an unknown location. Five troops came into the room where they were being held and continued beating them. This pattern of being moved around in vehicles between different locations, all the while being subjected to beatings, continued over several days. Finally, the men arrived at a location where they were forced to kneel on the floor, still restrained with handcuffs and blindfolded. Hassan said, "We all remained like this for 37 days, almost naked in the blistering cold, our bodies exhausted, our souls drifting away. The food was barely enough to keep you alive." When the men tried to complain about the conditions of their detention, their captors brought in troops with dogs. He said, "They unleashed them on us. The dogs would attack us, scratching us, while the commander would continue to beat us with utter brutality." Every few days, the men would be taken for questioning. Hassan said he was shown images of tunnels, and his interrogators would ask him what he knew about them. Hassan said, "Whenever I said that I didn't know anything, they would slap, punch, hit, and kick me all over my body. The troops with commander would make a lot of noise, so we were not able to sleep and remained exhausted and completely strained from fatigue, starvation, and torture." One night, in the early hours, as he tried to rest, Hassan was kicked awake by a Zionist regime troop and dragged to a bus with four other men. The bus took them to Karam Abu Salem, the main crossing between Israel and southern Gaza, where they were released. He said, "The commander screamed at us that we should walk quickly, but I could barely walk because of the beating and kneeling and the lack of food and sleep. The troops started running after us to scare us." Hassan said the men managed to drag themselves to nearby UN buses that were waiting to collect them. Maz Muhammad Khamis Meqda, 26, told MEE he had been rounded up at gunpoint by Israeli regime troops on December 21st while sheltering in a school with his family in Sheikh Radwan neighborhood of Gaza City. Along with other men, he was forced to strip. They were then taken to a nearby mosque where their hands were tied behind their backs and they were made to kneel. Meqda recalled, "Then they threw us in a truck, where more soldiers and security forces railed at us with massive beatings and cursing. The truck took them to a detention center, where the beatings continued relentlessly. They tortured us for hours, spraying us with cold water, while we were almost naked. They were determined to torture us and break us. Eventually, one by one, the men were taken to an interrogation room where Meqdad said the torture got worse. He said, "The soldiers asked where I was on October 7th and what I did. I told them I had nothing to do with the events of October 7th, but they didn't care. They attacked me with even more excessive punches and kicks, and this time with their weapons as well." Bruised and bleeding, the men were put in another truck and taken to a dark, cold room. Mehrdad said, "I was cold, beaten, starving, exhausted, and completely drained. If any prisoner fell asleep, the troops would viciously beat him on the head or chest to keep him awake. They wanted us to stay between life and death." After a couple of days, the men were put on a bus, this time with about 50 other prisoners. As the bus drove them to a detention center in another area, they were beaten by troops, this time armed with iron bars. Mehrdad said, "If anybody would scream in pain, they would beat him even harder." After 2 weeks in detention, Mehrdad said he was allowed to take a shower, but even this risked incurring a humiliating beating. He said, "The shower time was limited to 4 minutes. I was afraid to take off any clothes and never have it back. If you were a second late in the shower, the troops would tie you to metal bars and beat you for 4 hours. The troops and commanders would come and hit you with their weapons, metal bars, and boots. At night, the detainees were forced to sleep without any cover on the floor of what Mehrdad said appeared to be an army barracks. Loud music would play at full volume. During one interrogation, Mehrdad said he was asked why he had remained in Gaza City rather than going to the south, as the Zionist regime had told residents to do. He said he told them that he did not have the money to make the journey. He said they didn't like my answer. They sent me back to the dark prison room blindfolded. We were forbidden from making any movement or gesture. If we tried to adjust the blindfold to wipe away our tears and blood, the troops would go crazy, shouting at us and beating us insanely." Following the interrogation, Mehrdad said he was placed in a chair. He said, "They placed electric bands all over my body and electrocuted me with powerful shocks all the way to my head." After several more days of this treatment, Mehrdad was told he was being transferred. He was blindfolded and put on a bus. Many of the other men on the bus were sick and elderly, he said. The bus drove for a while and then stopped. They kicked us all out and threatened to shoot and kill anyone who moved from the line, or looked back, or tried to help one another. A young man was totally paralyzed from the harsh conditions, so I carried him despite the fact that I could barely carry myself. The troops saw me and started yelling and shooting, but I did not care. I just kept walking and didn't look back. In those moments, he was not heavy.
Hidden Files. The scientist gave no mind to security warnings that fateful day. He had to return from his vacation to teach a class the next day and wasn't going to let anyone stand in his way. After 14 years of high security, perhaps he was just ready to face his fate. Whatever it was, he hit the road, and not long afterwards, the news was blasted everywhere in the country. Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the father of Iran's nuclear science, had joined his martyred colleagues assassinated by the Israeli regime. But just who was Dr. Fakhrizadeh, and what had he done to deserve the honor of martyrdom? And why did the U.S. and Israeli regimes plan this assassination and more in hopes of dismantling Iran's nuclear program. Well, my dear colleague Maryam Azadeh is joining us with a bit of history on this topic. Maryam, please tell us more about Dr. Fakhrizadeh.
Well, thank you, Marzia, and greetings to our audience. Now, over the years, the authorities of the Islamic Republic have declared time and time again that the country's nuclear program is merely for peaceful purposes. Iran signed the Treaty of the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons in 1970, and careful investigations and reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency have shown the Islamic Republic's compliance with the treaty over the years. Even more reassuring than the treaty and the IAEA reports is the clear and strict stance of Islam that is the very foundation of the Islamic Republic. Even at the height of Saddam's invasion of Iran, when the Ba'athist regime in Iraq was bombing Iranian cities with chemical weapons, the late leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, declared that it's forbidden for the Iranian military to respond in kind. He himself prevented the production of chemical weapons on the grounds that Islam does not permit using weapons of mass destruction aimed to inflict harm on civilians. Then there's the verdict issued by the current leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khamenei, that reaffirms that the use of WMDs using chemical weapons and nuclear weapons is strictly forbidden in Islam. And yet the U.S., with well over 5,000 nuclear warheads, and the Israeli regime, with some 400 nuclear warheads, have committed countless crimes to stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program. But it seems that these crimes have only made Iranians more determined in their pursuit of nuclear technology.
I'm very happy to welcome to Hidden Files two of the sons of Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. We have Dr. Mehdi Fakhrizadeh and Dr. Hamid Fakhrizadeh. Welcome to the program. I'd like to start off with, of course, a very difficult time, the day that your father was assassinated. How did you find out about it?
In the name of the compassionate and merciful God, it was around 2:20 p.m. on November 27, 2020, when my mother called me and altered a sentence that echoed in our minds for 20 years. In that phone call, she simply said to me, "Mehdi, they've shot Dad." A three-word sentence I'd been waiting to hear every day for two decades. At the time of the call, the sounds of explosions and chaos were audible because my mother was the only one with my father. When I inquired about the location of the incident, I learned that the incident had occurred in Absard County. Immediately, we coordinated with my brothers and reached the site. When they had transported my father to Absard facility for initial treatments, we arrived and later, he was airlifted to a hospital in Tehran.
It's so difficult. I can't imagine. And your brother said you were waiting for this for 20 years. What does that mean? What is that like to be waiting to see if your father is going to be killed, become a martyr or not? What does it mean?
As my brother Mehdi mentioned, particularly in the last 15 to 20 years, life had been challenging for us. Despite my father's efforts to prevent security issues and pressures from affecting the family, the created security conditions had entangled the entire family. Nevertheless, he never abandoned his efforts to achieve his goals, which were nothing but the elevation and empowerment of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the country. The first attempt on his life dates back 20 years before his martyrdom, and during these two decades, there were four unsuccessful terrorist operations against him. In a video, Olmert speaks and says, "We wanted to assassinate Fakhrizadeh."
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
And when the reporter asks how well he knows Fakhrizadeh, he replies, "I know him well enough that if I see him in a crowded street, I can easily recognize him."
Well, what about you guys? I mean, did you ever say, "Okay, it's enough. It's too much pressure"?
No, خوشبختانه نه.
No, fortunately not. Anyway, a part of these tireless efforts, or as Iran's leader calls them, enduring efforts, belongs to our adolescence or a part of our childhood, which we understood to some extent. But our effort was one of our goals, and we are thankful that we were with him in understanding through mutual understanding, companionship, and solidarity.
You said pressure on you and also your children before and still.
Yes.
What kind of pressure right now? What are we talking about right now?
In two or three segments, we can define the pressure on the family. The first segment was before my father was introduced and recognized, meaning the time when he was on the hit list and attempts were made to assassinate him. Incidents had occurred, but intelligence and security services and the Zionist regime had not yet introduced him to the public. These pressures were internal and stemmed from concerns, anxieties, and potential losses. The second segment was when the intelligence services began to introduce him, meaning becoming recognized by the people. When he became known to the public, we too involuntarily became known, meaning we had to answer various questions. In many instances, we denied our relationship to inter-various fields, but in some cases, we couldn't deny it, and various kinds of damage were inflicted upon us. For example, one aspect that was not important to us, but turned out to be a positive outcome, was that many individuals in the business sector cut off their professional ties with us due to concerns that their business connections with us might lead to their sanctions. This was a part of the pressure at the time. After the martyrdom, some of the past pressures lingered, and new pressures were added. I want to mention a small emotional aspect, the loss of a prominent figure, which apart from being a prominent figure in the world and national arena, we have significant effects. We heard that during his lifetime, he was recognized by Foreign Policy magazine as one of 500 powerful figures globally. In any case, the world recognized him as someone who had accomplished significant events. This recognition of his personality also existed within the family. Nevertheless, when this powerful pillar is removed, everyone, relative to the depth of the relationship they had with him, is affected. An example is a question my youngest child, who was only 2 years and a few months old at the time of his martyrdom, still asks me, when will we become martyrs and join Grandpa? I emphasize that the discussion is not merely about his removal or exclusion from the nuclear issue. Of course, the majority of the issue was related to nuclear matters because it was a highly sensitive and a strategic matter for Iran. For Iran's enemies, a country like Iran being equipped with nuclear knowledge independently and without the need for another country with the long-standing sanctions was an unacceptable issue that they could not tolerate.
Okay, let me leave it right there because I'm going to ask a question a little bit later about that particularly. Okay. But you had mentioned about his personality. I want to talk a little bit about who he was as far as a father in the house, just his personality in general, hobbies. Tell me about your father.
It can be said that he had a multidimensional personality. When we look at the personal dimensions, we see he was a poet and a literary individual with a strong interest in literature and involvement in literary matters. In another dimension, when we look at his personality, we see that in the field of philosophy, he had his own opinions and thoughts. His entry into the realm of philosophy dates back to his 16 years of age when he became interested in philosophical subjects. Prominent philosophy professors acknowledged that when he came to the Sadr Philosophy Institute, he raised questions and had answers to those questions that did not even cross their minds. These subjects were not discussed in either the religious or university context, let alone providing answers to them. In the field of management, when you look at him, he managed a complex set of operations in 16 different areas. This involved working with hundreds of scientists and achieving results. One of his oldest colleagues and friends mentioned that Fakhrizadeh did nothing during his 30 years of service unless it was the first time in the country or the world.
What an amazing life that he had. With your father, you said that you had been waiting for that news for 20 years. What would he say to you all? Because obviously he knew that he was a target. What would he tell you about the possibility of him being martyred?
At various times, events occurred, and some of them we became aware of unintentionally, while others needed to be brought to our attention. So he did. Of the four or five instances of assassination attempts that happened to him, perhaps we became aware of one of them after his martyrdom, but we were involved in three or four of them during his lifetime. This was because we also had to be prepared for such events. Preparations had various aspects, and we had to be prepared for after his passing. Perhaps the paternal recommendations or last-minute advices are one of the interesting aspects of such events. Sometimes an individual may give advice once, but for us, within 20 years, we're always involved in these events, as if a person, if their death is destined to happen, experiences it once in sickness or deathbed, but it was on the brink of such events every day. Therefore, for us, every day was a final day, and he had last-minute recommendations for us every day.
Amazing, amazing. When did you find out about the type of projects that your father was involved in, or did you find out, did you know the importance of his work?
I have said this in several places. Just as much as my father was unknown to the people in work-related matters, he was also unknown to us. He was never in a situation to talk about projects or the work he was doing and achieving results at home. Even after 3 years, I still hear things about his work and projects that are new to me. Naturally, more than 90% of the activities carried out by Martir Fakhrizadeh or are currently ongoing are not open for discussion because they are confidential.
Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing life. Let me ask you, Mehdi, did you ever think maybe we shouldn't just insist on nuclear technology? For example, the Islamic Republic of Iran, of course, we know that there have been, you've mentioned, several nuclear scientists who have been martyred. We know the Islamic Republic has advanced technologies in various fields, from nano to stem cell technologies and others. What would you say, I mean, if Iran just gave up on its peaceful nuclear program? Why not?
There are two discussions or two dimensions here. One is the discussion of nuclear energy, the discussion of nuclear technology and nuclear knowledge. We're not only talking about nuclear energy, we're talking about nuclear technology and knowledge. Today, everyone knows that it has various applications and is among the fundamental and foundational sciences. It has diverse applications and is strategic for the country. Therefore, the country must focus on the development of nuclear science, even though it has been repeatedly emphasized, mentioned, and even examined that Iran's nuclear program is a peaceful program. Unlike many other countries, where their primary use of nuclear technology is for military purposes and violates human rights, Iran has a peaceful program. Today, good information is provided that exploitation must take place in various fields, including agriculture. Iran, like other countries, cannot and should not be deprived of using this knowledge and technology to secure the interests of its people and the residents of its cities. The second issue here is that knowledge, especially cutting-edge technologies, is empowering. Empowerment has various aspects, with the most significant being independence for powerful countries. These countries strongly resist dependence and do not want other countries to become independent. They always prefer to be in need and are inclined to maintain dependencies, reaching out to other countries.
Right. Well, your father wasn't the first scientist, as I just said, to be assassinated. And it was by the American and Israeli, of course, regimes. And these assassinations were not only to slow down, to halt the progress of individual projects, but also to send a message to others not to go into that field, not to do that. Do you think that they have been effective in sending that message to others or not?
Perhaps it was the morning after his martyrdom, a Saturday morning, when I explicitly, in the first interview I had with some television networks, wholeheartedly stated the following sentence: an arrogant regime such as Israel should fear the martyred Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as much as it feared him alive. This is a reality, at least in the events after the martyrdom, where in fact when we complete the puzzle of the assassinations, we come to two points. Firstly, they are genuinely still afraid of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and now they fear him even more. Secondly, the very subtle message of the Supreme Leader regarding his actions and activities, illustrating how impactful one can be not only within the geographical boundaries of their own country, but far beyond. One could boldly say that he was not just an Iranian scientist, but one of the greatest scientists of his time in the Islamic world. This is an undeniable fact. Some of the work he did was closely tied to his personality, knowledge, and capabilities. Naturally, after his martyrdom, these tasks cannot continue, or if they do, they may continue with less power or force. In certain areas, given his high managerial abilities, his work on succession planning and establishing suitable structures or projects and other matters would not necessarily come to a complete halt with his martyrdom. We certainly hope that, following the explicit orders of the leadership, all his scientific and technical activities in all areas he was involved in will continue. I would like to mention a point related to this matter which may be relevant to your question. At the beginning of the message announced by the Supreme Leader the day after the martyrdom of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, he states, an outstanding and distinguished nuclear and defense scientist. But where he wanted to say, go and carry out his work, he did not say, go and carry out his nuclear work or go and carry out his defense work, because the Supreme Leader knew perfectly well in which areas he was capable. Where he wanted to give orders for his activities, he used the phrase go and pursue his work seriously. Let the officials follow up on all his scientific and technical work in all areas he was engaged in. We hope that following this strict order of the Supreme Leader, the work will proceed well. I have said this many times. Iran has shown that the youth within its borders are all capable and worthy. This soil has nurtured Soleimani. This soil has nurtured Fakhrizadeh. This soil will never be devoid of individuals like Fakhrizadeh, and God willing, the work will proceed smoothly.
Do you have any final comments? I mean, if we look at the overall situation of the Islamic Republic of Iran now and technology, are you optimistic about the future of Iran?
Exactly. In any case, over the past 40 years, we have demonstrated that we can open the greatest peaks of knowledge and technology in various fields from within ourselves and relying on our own capabilities. This includes nuclear technology, nanotechnology, stem cells, computer science, and today, in artificial intelligence and more. We have international documentation, scientific articles published by Iranian youth in emerging fields demonstrate that Iran is highly capable and performs well. We have witnessed significant growth and advancements, and we envision a bright future for our country. In the end, the point I want to make is that the assassination of Martyr Fakhrizadeh and those like them is a blow not only to Iran or the Islamic world, but to human society. We lost a scientist, and they assassinated a scientist who was engaged in fundamental and foundational activities in the field of science, contributing to the beneficial development of human society. These assassinations occur to achieve malicious goals that certain groups have, not for the sake of human society or even for a specific nation. I emphasize that these assassinations occur for the sake of goals that certain groups have. Hopefully, the global community will wake up to this awareness and we will witness the confrontation with such behavior.